Seems I was speaking very soft yesterday. Many people did not hear from the back. So please, you know, shout at me. And also in statistical mechanics, we start with non-interacting system. And yesterday somebody asked me, how are the students? I told them they are non-interacting. But slowly we will go into interacting systems. Then you will start interacting with me and there will be more questions. So let me briefly review for about 5 minutes what we did yesterday. Yesterday was a gentle introduction to scope of statistical mechanics. I pointed out that the notion of thermodynamics and various laws of thermodynamics and various ideas goes beyond simple laws that we learn in Newtonian mechanics. There are very special things that happens when you have large number of degree of freedoms interacting or even non-interacting. So there is a general notion called emergence. The idea came from biology, apparently, where many, many surprises happen. There is evolutions and emergence at a variety of things. And in fact, there is a small anecdote. Niels Bohr was talking with a famous evolutionary biologist by name Ernst Mayr. So he was boasting about evolution, emergence in biology. And Niels Bohr said that all of physics is emergence. For example, if you take H2O, water molecule, it has some properties. But put few water molecules together, you have a new idea called hydrogen bonding, which is so important in biology and in physics of water and ice. Then you put more of them together, you have water. And then you make them flow, there is turbulence. And you make them evaporate, there are clouds and there are rains and so on. So the, all of physics is about emergence, according to Niels Bohr. But OK, so this is what I was trying to point out yesterday, that you can view thermodynamic phenomena and the science of thermodynamics as beginning of an emergence in matter. And then I pointed out in particular the so-called liquid gas critical point, very simple thing that we know, pressure versus temperature. So there is gas and there is liquid. So if I move across, there is a discontinuity in density. So liquid has higher density at the same temperature and pressure than vapor. Then if you move up along this line and reach the end point, namely critical point, the difference vanishes. So this critical state, which is denoted by the two parameter, critical pressure and critical temperature, is very unusual compared to a stable liquid and a stable gas. Because here it's struggling between being a vapor or being a liquid. So it leads to fluctuations which happen at all length scales. Consequently, the mathematics behind you know, these fluctuations becomes very complicated and it starts encompassing many, many new ideas in mathematics. But as I pointed out, that if you look at the nature of fluctuations in two-dimensional liquid gas system or two-dimensional lattice gas system, the mathematics of that and the physics of that is related to conformal field theory, so which requires all kinds of mathematics in its full description. So a very simple phenomena in liquid gas. And if you focus on critical point, there is an emergence of many variety of new things. So this is what happens in condensed matter physics. Repeatedly, there are corners and points where many, many interesting things happen, which could give ideas, you know, like to string theorists, like one corner in condensed matter physics, namely superconductivity, gave idea to Nambu that the superconducting gap that you observe in the experiment, and also you see in the theory, could be connected to mass gap or the mass in elementary particle physics. So that was the beginning of a whole new era, starting with Higgs mechanism, Nambu mechanisms, and so on. So deep insights gained from quantum matter, in unexpected corners gives you new visions about the entire universe sometime or some other places. Okay, so this is what I was telling about emergence. What I said was that the equilibrium statistical mechanics that we study looks at few of these emergent properties. When you move away from equilibrium statistical mechanics, there are many, many new things that's happening, including biological phenomena and life. Since we are, I'm dwelling on this critical point, let me take a piece of stone and, let's say, a living being like us. If you look at a piece of stone, let's assume it's a crystal. So at a finite temperature, there are thermal vibrations, otherwise it is ordered. There may be finite temperature effects like vacancy creation and interstitial. So the atoms may move away from its home site and then move around as an interstitial. So there may be vacancies which move around. So nothing more interesting is going on in a solid. Whereas if you take a living object like a human being or a horse, you find that there are activities happening at nanosecond time scales at the scale of atoms. There are hydrogen bonds which are being constantly broken. There are chemical reactions, ATP hydrolysis, and various things going on in order to supply energy to move, for example, a molecular motor. So things keep happening from shortest time scale that we can imagine to the longest time scale, like minute and so on. So we have blood flow occurring in the entire body. So if you take a biological or living system, then the language of Perbach, it is like a self-organized critical state with lots and lots of specialities and hierarchies. And this is a very, in some sense, a trivial critical state. There is no life there. However, it gives you some idea to understand very complex systems like, you know, a living system. So these are all new directions that will emerge, you know, that will keep coming in the study of physics. Then towards the end, I was pointing out a very simple thought experiment that take two well-isolated system with number of particles N1 and energy E1 and energy E2 and N2. And then in a microcanonical ensemble description, which I will come to, a state is defined by the number of particles and the energy and the number of possible states it can have. You can think of it quantum mechanically or volume of phase space consistent with these two constraints that the number is N1 and energy is U1. So we denote it by omega 1 and omega 2. Then I said that let's bring the system together and let it start exchanging energy. So energy will flow from here to there or there to there. I keep the number of particles fixed. So correspondingly, as the energy changes, the microstates also will change. So a general state will be denoted by with the constraint that U1 plus E2 is equal to E. Then the only postulate that we make in finding out the nature of the equilibrium state that emerges after we start energy to be exchanged between the two systems is that the phase space volume or the corresponding entropy should be maximized. So any system in equilibrium would like to have explore all possible states, maximum number of possible states. So the energy will adjust itself so that this product is a maximum. That immediately led to the notion that if you take the derivative of this with respect to energy, I showed that the thing that characterizes a stable or equilibrium situation is that the temperature of the two subsystems are the same, where temperature is defined through the relation where this omega is related to e to the power of s entropy. This is what I was showing yesterday. So a very simple thought experiment, making some hypothesis that the system is in equilibrium when it has, for a given energy, the maximum number of microstates. Okay, so this is what I did yesterday. And if you have any questions in yesterday's talk, I'll be happy to answer, or we can proceed today with what I plan to do. So what I plan to do today is discuss phase space, Hilbert space, and the Liouville theorem. And then Gibbs distribution. And then various ensembles, microcanonical, canonical, and grand canonical. So this is what I plan to do today. So we are all familiar with phase space. Already we saw briefly that if you have a collection of classical particles, their state can be uniquely defined if you specify the moment, their momentum and the position. So these p's and q's are three vectors. They live in three-dimensional space. So this collection is a six n-dimensional phase space, where n is the number of particles. So in principle, if you know the Hamiltonian of the system, that there is a kinetic energy and there are potential energy of interaction among the particles, in principle, you can solve Newton's equation for a given initial condition and find out whatever happens after some instant of time. So that is not advisable to do it now because it will take too much time, because we have large number of particles, 10 to the power of 23 of the order of Avogadro number. So there should be something else based on our experimental observation. That is, as I said yesterday, we observe nature. I take a piece of stone, it remains stable in our time scale. Even I take air in a beaker, it remains stable. If you take even if there is a turbulent water, if you focus on a small volume of the water has, let's say, constant temperature and density doesn't fluctuate in our time scale. So there is something stable about this aggregates, macroscopic Avogadro number of atoms and molecules. So there should be some easy description of this, which is what people like Maxwell, Boltzmann, and Gibbs started thinking about. So their various notions came. One is so-called ergodic hypothesis. Many of these things are intuitively obvious, but to show rigorously, it requires an enormous effort. In fact, there are people doing mathematical physics worry a lot about ergodic hypothesis, how to prove it for few degrees of freedom, large number of degrees of freedom, and so on. This is also related to the notion of molecular chaos. So the idea is very simple. Suppose I go to this phase space, and then there is at least one conserved quantity, because suppose I have an isolated system, the energy is conserved. Let me say E is the energy of the system. Let me call it as E naught. So, and then the Hamiltonian with this P and Q, energy has to be constant. That is, I may move in the six n dimensional hyperspace, then the energy has to remain the same, which means that this equation defines a 6n minus 1 dimensional hypersurface. Let me schematically denote it like this. So this is 6n minus 1 dimensional hypersurface. It is embedded in a bigger surface. Now, all of statistical mechanics is about nature and volume of this surface. And it's remarkable if you think about it, even though schematically I have drawn a very simple surface, like a two-dimensional sheet, it's a very complicated beast because it's a very high-dimensional object. As you change the parameter, namely energy, this surface and its very simple property, namely volume, undergoes very subtle modifications and singularities, which is what manifests itself as phase transitions. So even to understand the nature of this surface, for a simple thing like ideal gas, this already involves a little bit of mathematics. When it comes to non-ideal gas, it becomes even more complicated, and that's what we try to do. So the statement is the following. There is, suppose I start at time t equals 0 at some point in the phase space. I know the exact position of the particle and then the exact momentum of all the particles. So in principle, I can solve Newton's equations of motion, and it will exhibit some trajectory. Now, the hypothesis of all these people, Boltzmann and Maxwell and others, was basically that if you wait long enough, this trajectory will go to every point in phase space, not every point, arbitrarily close to it. Now, when I make all these statements, I'm being very loose and I'm being very qualitative. I do not specify what is my epsilon and what is my delta. If I were a mathematician, I will define that. Now I will assume that there is some phase space, and I start with some point. Even starting with a point is a luxury, because it's very difficult to specify Avogadro number of particles, positions, and velocity. So you could imagine, like a physicist, a region. That is, there are always uncertainty in specifying the momentum and position. So you can say there is some small volume in phase space. And if you keep track of that volume, as a function of time, it keeps moving. And the ergodic hypothesis essentially says that the motion in the long time scale, long run, covers the entire phase space with probability 1. So there are many, many qualifications. But if you read Landau and Lifshitz, the book on statistical mechanics, he will make many, many physical statements about what system we are considering, why this is meaningful, and why this hypothesis is physical, and so on. So this is the basic idea. The idea is that the point will affect travel to every region. Suppose you give me a region having some finite volume, our physical trajectory will pass through that. So after some time, you will find that if you draw the trajectory, it will be densely filled with this. Now, there is also another interesting thing. You could have started, instead of starting from here, somewhere else with a different initial condition, because initial conditions are specified by 6n coordinates. Then you can watch it. That initial condition also will move you in the same way and fill up the phase space. Except, you know, there are always, when you discuss like this, there are always exceptions. For example, you could have started with a crystalline configuration in which atoms form a solid and then leave it in some corner, and it may occupy a small volume, and it may get stuck to that volume. It may never evaporate and never become a gas. It is true. But the statement is such configurations are minorities. In some sense, in the probability extent, they are of measure 0. So most of the configurations that you see are a friendly type, which is very disordered. So you could start with any configuration. With very high probability, the trajectories of those set of states that you start with will fill up the phase space. So your final result will be independent of the initial starting point. It's better be, because if I look at a piece of, a drop of water, whatever I observe, namely macroscopic properties, should not depend on what was the position and momentum of all the water molecules 10 hours ago. So this is related to molecular chaos. In the chaos theory, what you say is that, suppose you look at a dynamical system, you start with some initial condition, some initial state, then evolve it. It reaches some state after some time. Then change the initial condition slightly. It reaches a state which is far from what you had with a slightly modified initial condition. So this is related to chaos. You all know about it. So in some sense, the molecules and atoms are colliding with each other. They very quickly become chaotic. And essentially, you start filling up the phase space. So this is a very important hypothesis. Now, people like Boltzmann, what he will say is that with this ergodic hypothesis, you can replace time average by average over various configurations. Now, it was all put together, and very beautiful theory was developed by Gibbs, who introduced the notion of, I think also Boltzmann, the notion of probability distribution in phase space, given the constraint. Yes.
Integrals of motion, which you always do get, right? So, for example, the momentum is conserved, and so in that case, your motion is on a submanifold of your manifold there, and
so,
it never goes outside.
So that's a very good point. So let me take interacting particles. So total energy is conserved, and then total momentum is also conserved, and total angular momentum also is conserved. So you let me take a system which is at rest, for like a drop of water. So the total momentum is zero. So you will find that particles moving back and forth, but that net momentum is zero. Similarly, I imagine angular momentum zero. So the hypersurface will be big enough if you include some of these conservation laws. So I have got a hypersurface of 6n minus 1 dimensional volume by taking care of energy conservation. If I look at momentum conservation, I will look at a subsection of it, which is still large, 6n minus 3. If I take angular momentum conservation, it will be 6n minus 7, and so on. So the phase space is big enough when you go to, because these are all, fortunately, for non-integrable systems, the number of conservation laws is finite. So when you deal with so-called conservative system where there are sometimes the number of conservation laws are as large as the number of degree of freedom, then the physics is slightly different. There are, I will not go into the details of those. So this is about ergodic hypothesis. So Gibbs introduced so-called distribution function in phase space. So then, as Landau and Lipschitz says, the greatest problem in statistical mechanics is to find this distribution function. In microcanonical ensemble, you escape this by saying that you visit every place, and the only thing that you need to do is to count the volume of phase space. So that essentially solves the problem. Then when you come to canonical and grand canonical ensemble, you have to be a little more liberal. You'll have to find out a distribution function. So this is where probability theory comes. That is, this essentially says, what is the probability with which you will find, what is the probability you will find all particles with momentum p1, p2, p3, and position q1, q2, p3. So the greatest contribution from Gibbs is, Gibbs, Boltzmann, and others is, they gave an explicit form for this probability distribution function, which we all know very well for, let's say, classical systems. As there is an anecdote described in the book by Dan Matis on statistical mechanics, apparently he and Schrieffer were classmates at Urbana-Champaign. Matis did not like statistical mechanics course, so he wanted some help from Schrieffer. Schrieffer said that, please don't worry about everything in statistical mechanics. Statistical mechanics is just this, e to the minus beta h. So he wrote in a piece of paper, if you appreciate this, that's statistical mechanics. So the greatest contribution from Gibbs, Boltzmann, and others is this distribution. So now, in the next rest of the time, we will see how this distribution comes about in various ensembles. So first, let us focus on, so this, you know, I am rushing through this very fast. And if you do not want to rush, please go to Landau and Lipschitz. There it's discussed in two chapters. Very elaborate discussion about what is the meaning of this, how sharp is this, are these statements. So basically, the statement is that, suppose I take a gas. It's a stable system. So I may have a big container in which the energy of all this, the total energy is constant, but often I focus on a small volume, which is small compared to the big volume, but still macroscopic. So instead of thinking about heat bath and so on, what I say is I focus on a small volume in real space and matter contained in that, and then try to understand the physics of it in terms of this distribution. So, and then there is also issues about time scale, because I very in a very loose way I said that you start from here and they quickly fill up phase space. How much time does it take? Will it take the age of the universe or will it take seconds? In fact, you can do computer experiments and find out that very quickly it starts equilibrating. And this is related to Boltzmann equation and time-dependent change in distribution functions and so on. So in this context, a very, very important theorem, namely Liouville equation, comes. So this and Liouville's theorem. This formalizes some of the statements that I made before and gets equations for such phase space distribution functions. Because finally, even though I have a distribution function in terms of position and momentum variable, these individual variables do depend on time through Newton's laws of motion. So it will be nice to find out an equation satisfied by this distribution, like Schrodinger equation for wave function, or position and momenta in Hamilton equation or Newton's equations of motion. So the thought experiment, in fact, there is a very nice book by Gibbs. It was written in 1901, just beginning of last century, where he discusses all these things in a very beautiful way, in a very elaborate way with old notation. But the basic idea is the following. That I go to this six-dimensional configuration space, and then imagine a gas there. So it's not the gas in real space. So I, for example, a point in the six-dimensional configuration space will tell me the state of n particles, all their positions and all their momenta. So that means I imagine a system in my mind, which has this specific phase space point, and I imagine another system in mind, which has another set of phase space point, and so on. So this mental construct, they are called ensembles. That is, I imagine identical systems whose microscopic states are very different. So I represent each microscopic state, the microscopic state of each member of the ensemble by a point. And then I fill up my phase space with some set of points. Then I turn on my Hamiltonian and allow them to evolve. For example, this will move in some way, this will move in some way, this will move in some way. Very quickly, they will start filling up phase space. Now, the argument by Gibbs and others is basically, there is something interesting about this phase space points or the phase space fluid that I start with. I can use continuity equation. That is, if I consider a small volume and if the density increases, the number of points in this phase space volume, if the number of points increases, it's because some of them are entering or some of them are leaving. So I should be able to write down a continuity equation for this phase space distribution function. So now I have a density in six n dimensional phase space. This is a construct. I have considered several members of an ensemble. I consider an ensemble where there are several members. I specify the density at the initial time. And then I allow it to evolve in time. And then I have this equation. Now this V will be the velocity or the current in six n dimensional phase space. That's something very straightforward and important. We are used to continuity equation in three dimension. Now we are thinking about continuity equation in six n dimensional phase space. Now we make a very important assumption, which is related to this ergodic hypothesis, that if you start with a set of phase space points, it has no explicit time dependence, because every point I start with essentially covers phase space in some way, and at the end of the day, I will find some uniform distribution which is not changing in time. So it is as if it's an incompressible fluid. Things move here and things move out. So from an observer from outside, whatever density I have has no explicit time dependence. So that means this term is zero. So I have to only focus on this term. Now, this time derivative, this derivative is d by dq x I plus d by similarly for momenta and summed over all particles from 1 to n. So that is this derivative, and these velocities are q1x dot, q2x dot, and so on, and similarly for momenta, p1x dot, so yes.
So this is an assumption, this is an answer.
So in my thought experiment, the way, for example, Landau-Lipschitz does, I take a big system, I look at subsystems in several regions in the three-dimensional space, I can imagine each of them to be a member of the ensemble. So the statement is that at an instant of time, this member of the ensemble will occupy some place, another member will occupy another point in phase space. So now, after some time, this member would have gone to another point in phase space, so would have the other. So if equilibrium statistical mechanics, that the way that we see in nature, the equilibrium thermodynamical system, if those equilibrium states are real phenomena, it implies that rho has no explicit time dependence. That is, I started with phase space points, allow them to evolve, and then they have filled up the phase space in some uniform way, and after that, there may be transient at which, you know, things are changing. But if we wait long enough for thermodynamic equilibrium to reach.
Oh, so you're always in equilibrium.
Exactly. Okay. So yeah, that's right. That's important. Yeah. So I reach an asymptotic state, which is an equilibrium state. There, this statement is true. Now here I have the continuity equation in six n dimensional phase space. Now I have derivatives of momenta and derivative of positions. Now I can use Hamilton equations of motion. And then this is a little bit of algebra. I don't want to go into the detail because I'm sure to make some mistakes. It's just straightforward two-step. What you find is that this equation essentially implies that d rho by dt okay, let me attempt to. I have it here, I'll so write it down. I should bring the second one down. So when I consider the derivative of this, these derivatives will act on rho and also will act on v. So the first set of terms will be summation over I d rho by d q I because this velocity which is a vector which contains Q dots and P dots. Similarly, d rho by d pi, pi dot, okay? Then there will be a term which will act on the velocities, so it will contain dqi dot dqi plus dpi dot dpi. So this will be the sets of term. Now for this, I can use the Hamilton equations of motion because I know that qi dot is equal to dh by dqi. Similarly, pi dot with a minus. So if you use this and substitute it in this part of the equation, it will vanish. You can easily see. So you are left with this. And this is nothing but total derivative of rho. So because rho has no explicit time dependence, all time dependences come through q's and p's. So I take derivative with respect to q, and I have q dot with respect to q. So this is identified with. So I get the very, very interesting, important result called Liouville's theorem. It says, in equilibrium, sometimes it looks like a tautology, but apparently it's more deep. It's deeper than that. We'll not go into the question of that. So this is very interesting because it tells me that rho is a conserved quantity. And we have a Hamiltonian system. And there are seven conserved quantities, namely energy, the center of mass momentum, three variables, and the angular momentum of the whole system, three variables. So there are seven conserved quantities. So that means this rho has to be an explicit function of energy or momentum, which we call it P, and then angular momentum, yeah. Because it's a constant, it doesn't change with time. Now we have some more inputs. We say that if I have two subsystems which are close by, at the scale of the subsystems, they don't communicate with each other. Any interaction between the two subsystems is through the surface. So it says that the energies are additive. If we have considered one subsystem here and another subsystem, the total energy is U1 plus U2. And if we use that language, you will find that basically that the phase space distribution function for the two subsystem, rho 1 2, is rho 1 times rho 2. In other words, log of rho 1 2 is log of rho 1 plus log of rho 2. And we know that energy of two subsystems are additive. So this implies that in general, the rho distribution function will be some constant alpha plus beta times energy plus some vector gamma times total angular momentum, another vector delta times angular momentum. So very important results. As I said, it's discussed at length in Landau and Lipschitz. Just following from this, we say that the distribution function has to be a function of integral constants of motion. And the most important constant of motion for us is energy. So the distribution function, log of distribution function, there is some constant and it's proportional to energy. And then it could be proportional to the net momentum of the system and net angular momentum. In most of the equilibrium systems that we have, we consider momentum to be zero, total momentum, similarly angular momentum. There are situations in which you have to study equilibrium properties of rotating objects, like a globular cluster or some rotating droplet of liquid. Many, many situations it occurs. Similarly, there may be situations in which things are moving. But in the standard equilibrium statistical mechanics, we focus on net momentum zero, net angular momentum zero. So in that situation, we essentially have this thing that log of rho is alpha plus beta e. So from Liouville's equation and then looking at it, then we get some idea about equilibrium distribution function. Asymptotically, what will be the nature of the, yes?
So dp and m are the only additive constants of motion?
Yes. Okay, that's a very good question. Suppose I take well-known systems like a collection of particles interacting with Lennard-Jones potential. Okay. Then the three, the seven constants of motions follow simply from Euclidean translation in space and time. It just follows from translation invariance. Anything other that you get normally in so-called integrable system is a luxury. It's a luxury. It normally doesn't happen. So if it happens, it happens for very specific systems, very tuned systems. For example, if you take hydrogen atom, you get some extra symmetries coming from so-called, some Lorentz vector. So, and if you change the central potential, 1 over r in hydrogen atom to 1 over r to the power 1 plus epsilon, that symmetry changes. So there are accidental symmetries and conserved quantities, but a generic system will be characterized by these integrals of motion. In fact, when we come to spin systems, you will find there are so-called integrable systems where there are more than one integral of motion. And they are very unique to some very specific so-called integrable models. And they also take you to very beautiful mathematics. Yes.
Did you go to a frame where P and M are zero?
You could say that, yeah, for example, within Galilean invariance. Yeah, so in the lab frame, my system is at rest with respect to my frame, so I can put it equal to zero. Now, all these notions get highly non-trivial when you go to relativistic statistical mechanics, because then you'll have to obey Lorentz invariance and various things. I will not touch it at all. We are talking about simple non-relativistic equilibrium systems. Okay, so this is so far so good. It's about any question?
Can you repeat why the rho depend only on the integral motion?
Because of this. So it says p's and q's are changing with time, but at the end of the day, through my derivation, I have shown that this is a constant independent of time. Now, the only constant independent of time in my problem is the Hamiltonian, or total momentum, or total angular momentum. That's why. Okay. So now, so far, so good. Now let me go to the next step, which is so now, having done this, we'll step back to microcanonical ensemble, and then go to canonical and grand canonical ensemble in the next half an hour. I think that should be. So since many of you have had exposure to these things at some level or other, I'm being very sketchy and I don't complete the things, but I try to focus on salient points. So please go back and look at books and sharpen your understanding. Somebody down. So I have to make way for somebody. Yeah.
I only have one concern on this. That if you, if I take this to mean that I'm going to a certain preferred reference frame to do this analysis, then, for example, I might be in a frame which is spinning. And if it's spinning, then I have potentials that appear, fictitious potentials that appear, and I don't satisfy Hamilton's equation, like the same way that I don't satisfy Newton's second law without adding them.
Yeah, so I'll have to add corresponding Coriolis force and so on.
Yes. And so why couldn't you in general keep angular momentum or something like that?
So if I then what you will find is if that's like a Lagrange multiplier. So suppose I have a delta, which is a Lagrange multiplier, and then do averages in this particular distribution function what I will find is my macroscopic system has an angular momentum in the direction given by delta. And the amount will be determined by the magnitude of delta. So I could do that. So then I will end up describing, in other words, the phase space as described by that distribution function has with probability when every point has a macroscopic motion, angular momentum. Yes. So I will have to do it for some situations, and then I will find densities start, you know, changing and so on. Yeah. Okay. Now the next thing is, so let me spend 10 minutes on microcanonical ensemble. It's conceptually the simplest thing, but mathematically it's very complicated. Nobody uses microcanonical ensemble in calculating things. I will just point out how difficult it is to get the PV equal to RT, the well-known ideal gas equation, using microcanonical ensemble. But conceptually, it's very important. It tells you many things. And so here, the idea is very simple. It says you basically count the number of states . So this is a delta function, and then you have some volume of phase space. In fact, I have no time to go into it. I'm sure you have come across this. There will be n factorial, because I have identical particle, and then there will be some L by Planck's constant to the power of 3n. This is volume of phase. This is some normalization constant. After that, omega is a dimensionless quantity. That's why I have this. Now I look at this. So this basically goes to the phase space and basically finds what is the volume in this 6n 1 minus 1 dimensional configuration space. Suppose I'm able to calculate this for a given interacting system, then that's all statistical mechanics as far as I'm concerned. And in particular, this omega e, that is log of, is the entropy. So if I manage to find omega e, which will depend on the system property. For example, it will depend on the mass of the particle because there is a kinetic energy, depends on the two-body interaction potential because there is a potential energy. But at the end of the day, there is one function, which is omega of e. And in principle, all macroscopic quantities can be deduced if I know this omega of e. Because as I said, once I have omega of E, I can calculate entropy. Once I have entropy, I can calculate for that given energy what is the temperature. That is, I have a particular energy, I take derivative of the function at that particular energy, then that gives me what temperature I am in. Now you can invert this equation because this is a function of E. You can solve E for as a function of T. That will give me what is the internal energy. Once I have internal energy, I can calculate specific heat. Similarly, I can calculate pressure and so on. So one quantity, namely the number of microstates, omega E, has all thermodynamic information. So let me first discuss schematically how does this look like. Now, this is very important. For simplicity, let me take a spin system. I am not going to phase space and counting volume in 6n dimensional space. And this will become very important because also it tells us something remarkable about phase space and Hilbert space. So when you do classical statistical mechanics, and when you study liquid and gas and solid, you worry about the atomic coordinates, basically momentum and positions of the particles. But people doing laboratory experiments, nuclear magnetic resonance, or people doing magnetism, worry about different sets of degrees of freedom. Because suppose I'm studying a ferromagnet. It is true there are atoms, they are vibrating. They are undergoing thermal motions. But however, I am focusing on a particular degree of freedom, namely spin. So in my mental, in the thought experiment, or when I do calculation, I decouple the degrees of freedom of atom and focus only on the spin degree of freedom. So this is something that we routinely do in statistical mechanics. So very often, we don't worry about phase space of atomic positions and momenta. We focus on Hilbert space of spin degree of freedom. Sometimes, in a superfluid like helium 3, we have to worry about phase space and there is superfluidity and so on, so we take them together. We have possibility of pairing of helium 3 atoms and superfluidity, and also helium 3 nuclei has a spin half moment. So judiciously, depending on the situation, we separate our degrees of freedom and focus on that. So we do statistical mechanics of subsystem. In fact, if you think about it, even studying a liquid like water, we forget about proton spin. It doesn't matter for practical purposes. We forget about quarks that make up a proton. Because in some sense, three quarks bind to give you a proton. After that, quark is no more an essential degree of freedom at our energy scales and temperature scale. If you go to the interior of star, there will be quark, gluon, plasma, and so on. So very often, in physics, when we discuss some range of energy, some range of time scales, it is sufficient to focus on relevant degrees of freedom. So in that sense, spin degree of freedoms are very relevant. So I will plot a curve, and then so I take a very simple so-called one-dimensional spin system. This is called Ising model. It says that I have atoms forming a chain. They are coupled. I don't bother how they are coupled. There is some distance between the neighboring atoms. And there is a spin here, and there is another spin here. They have a coupling. It's a ferromagnetic coupling through an exchange interaction, J. So this is a system I have. It's a model system. In reality, there will be coupling between distant neighbors, but I throw them away. In fact, this is another important thing. In physics, whenever we focus on, let's say, a subsystem, we try to prune it as much as possible and keep the irreducible minimum complication. Already that's complicated. For example, there may be a 10% of next nearest interaction. But in trying to understand what I'm going to say, that may be relevant. So model building is a very, very important part in physics. So one should be ready to throw away things that are unimportant. But keep it in mind we have thrown away sometimes, because sometimes they will come back with great force. So it's somebody says model building in physics is like an art. You compare with experiments, keep going back and forth, and don't get stuck to your own model. Because often things that you throw away can become important. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is, now instead of Hilbert's phase space, now I have 2 to the power of n dimensional Hilbert space, because each spin can be up or down. So 2 states, I have n state, 2 times 2 times 2 up to n. So this is the dimension of my Hilbert space that I'm dealing with. Now, it's very clear that if you take this Hamiltonian, the ground state, all spins are up, so I have basically, this is a minimum energy state. So the energy is extensive proportional to the number of spins, and it is minus times j, minus j times n. So if I plot it in this diagram, so I'm going to plot energy. So this is a ground state energy, per spin is minus j. So what I'm going to draw is S as a function of E, where S is log of omega. That is basically number of spin states at a given energy. And you will agree that it will be a delta function, because I have discrete variable plus or minus 1. So not all continuous values are allowed. But I can plot histograms, for example, but or I can look at it as a function of this energy per particle, which will be almost like a continuous variable. So you can imagine one excited state in which spins are like this, up. So-called antiferromagnetic state, up, down, up, down. The energy of this will be plus J per particle. So let me call it as maximally excited state. And that will be here. There is one unique state, which is a ferromagnetic state. There is another unique state, which is antiferromagnetic, which has maximum energy. Now, you can play with this. And in fact, you can do calculations analytically for this, basically counting number of states in a given energy interval. What you will find is, I will not prove it, it will be like this. You will enjoy doing this calculation because it's straightforward. You may have to do some approximation. So this is the log of the many body density of states. So this is called density. That is, you take an energy E and look at energy interval E plus delta E and count the number of many body states available. That is, you look at, put all spin configurations. There are 2 to the power of n of them. So if you integrate over all states, you will get 2 to the power of n. OK. So for even for this simple problem, it's somewhat difficult to get this analytical form, but please try to get it. But what is interesting is now you can ask the question, what is temperature? According to the statistical mechanics, this is, suppose I am at some energy E, and I look at that point and look at the slope. The inverse of the slope tells me what is the temperature. So if I keep coming down, if I am at this point, this is taking off vertically. So all states in this neighborhood corresponds to zero temperature or close to it. So this is something remarkable that when I study thermodynamics of a system which has an internal energy U, only states in the neighborhood contribute. Things farther away do not come. We will come to that later, how small their probability are. Now, if you keep going, something interesting happened. You can ask a question, what is the infinite temperature state that corresponds to, because the slope is zero? Now, here is, I do not know how many of you heard about negative temperature. OK, good. So it's a very beautiful system concept. This simple example I gave allows you possibility of negative temperature, because what I have enumerated, namely number of microstates as a function of energy, keeps going up and reaches a maximum and then comes down. So in principle, I can focus on a point here. Then if I look at slope here, it is negative. So there is a negative temperature or negative beta value. So it turns out, if you focus on spin system like nuclear spins, you can polarize a spin. For example, they may have antiferromagnetic interaction among themselves. Then you can polarize a spin by artificial means and then make it behave like a system having a negative temperature. And there are very interesting discussions about it in elementary statistical mechanics textbook. So negative temperatures are possible and they are real. And now, if I had started with phase space, like interacting particles, it's very difficult to reach this situation because there it keeps going up. And also, I want to point out there are notions like Hegedorn temperature in high energy physics. That's also related to the behavior of this density of states, many body density of states. OK. So this is very good. It looks very nice. So if I want to solve any many body problem, want to do statistical mechanics of, let's say, high temperature superconductor described by a repulsive Hubbard model, what all I have to do is just solve for the spectrum of the many body Hamiltonian. And that's a difficult part. Not even solve for the spectrum in the sense of exact eigenvalue and the exact eigenfunction. Just give me information about how many states are available in an energy interval. It turns out that holds all the secret of statistical mechanics. Now let me digress a little bit. It turns out this Hamiltonian I started with, a simple thing in which you can play with and get this density of states, does not have any critical phenomena. We will come to it later. Why it does not have? Because it's one dimension, fluctuations are so strong, even cooperation among the spins finally give up at long distances and things start fluctuating, and there is never a long range order or spontaneous symmetry breaking in this model. But you can make it slightly more general, which is what Ansager did many years ago. He said that let me take spins on a lattice and then let them have coupling among neighbors. Then this becomes, this means I stands for a lattice set, let's say M comma M, denoted by the column and the row index. And then this bracket in means that they are nearest neighbors. Then it turns out this system does remarkable things like spontaneous symmetry breaking, ferromagnetism at low temperature, and so on. For example, if you take this system, it was shown by Ansager, that if you calculate magnetization, that is the average value of spin as a function of temperature, it will be non-zero at low temperature and then vanish exactly at a critical temperature. So this is a paramagnet, this is a ferromagnet. This is what Ansager calculated. Now, you can ask the question, where is this reflected here? Because I have a continuous density of states. It turns out there is a point, or there is an internal energy which corresponds to that critical temperature. Let me say that this is that point. So this is a critical energy. Then what we find is this continuous curve has some weak singularity, some kink. It is continuous everywhere, but if you take derivative, it will exhibit some divergence and singularity. So the entire phenomenon of phase transition is contained in this very simple looking curve as singularities appearing as some basically non-electricity as a function of this energy, a particular internal energy. For every internal energy, there is a corresponding temperature which you can calculate through this rule. So this is remarkable. And in some sense, this curve hides information about critical phenomena that I talked about yesterday. For example, here in the ferromagnet, when I am sitting at this point, things are very critical because I am debating to go between a disordered state to an ordered state in which all spins are up or all spins are down. So I am confused. So I'll find domains of spins, of up spins and domains of down spin as large as you wish. If I take a thermodynamic movement, there will be very large clusters, there will be very small clusters. So they will be uniform, they will be distributed in a scale-free way. So that is a critical state. So all that information is contained in this very one simple function S of E. So in that sense, microcanonical ensemble conceptually is very nice. But in practice, to calculate it is very hard. OK, the next 5 minutes, I will show you how complicated it is to calculate a microcanonical ensemble for free gas, Boltzmann gas. I should also point out that, you know, in many of these discussions, I forgot to mention, when I say classical free gas, it is with a pinch of salt. If you take non-interacting particles, let's say you keep them moving in one direction, they will never equilibrate. So in all these things, it means you allow for a sufficiently weak interaction among particles so that they equilibrate, but they don't really contribute to internal energy. So there is a sense in which particles are free. So they are so weakly interacting that gas remains a gas, a liquid remains gas remains a gas. And so this small interaction is there to reach equilibrium in a physical time scale. Otherwise, they will never reach equilibrium. So that is something that you should remember. So now what I'm going to do is to calculate thermodynamic free energy and so on using microcanonical ensemble. So if you look at a book like Kersen Huang, he starts with this quantity. since it's non-interacting gas, I don't need to worry about potential energy. So I have an integration over Q. And then basically I have, with the constraint that I look at the volume of phase space such that the energy is less than, that is integrated over all regions of phase space, so that the energy is less than a particular energy E. So it is as if there is a phase space, I go up to some point where the energy is E. Now if you look at the derivative of this, will give me the desired epsilon, called density of states, that energy, number of states available in energy interval E and epsilon, E plus epsilon E. Okay. Now, this is very simple. It means in this case, so this integral is very straightforward. I can perform it and I get volume to the power of n. Then, of course, I'll have to put an n factorial. Again, I will not go into the details. This is related to the so-called Gibbs paradox and the nature of identical particles. This is something very interesting. Even before quantum mechanics came, in enumerating microstates, Gibbs came across a paradox that if you think about each particle as identical, he found out that if you take the same gas in two different regions and put them together, you end up with some wrong counting and a wrong formula for entropy. So he suggested one way to overcome is to say that all particles are identical. So I find out the space's volume and then take care of identical character by dividing it by n factorial, because I could permute these particles among n factorial, among themselves in n factorial ways, and all configurations are identical. And in fact, that's what we learn in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, when you come to wave function description, you cannot call identical particle as different. That is, the wave function should be either symmetric or antisymmetric with respect to permutations of coordinates. So that kind of information somehow sneaks in classical statistical mechanics just before the advent of quantum mechanics. It's very important. In fact, there is something called Sakur tetrode formula about entropy of mixing and so on. Anyway, I will not go into it. So this is what I have to calculate and take derivative. This is basically volume of a sphere in 6n-dimensional space. And this, finally, you can calculate the volume. And the volume turns out to be 3n-dimensional spaces, r to the power of n, where r is square root of m. That is, from the energy, I calculate the maximum radius in phase space times this is the formula for volume in phase space. So you have gamma functions and so on. Then, since n is very large, you'll have to calculate asymptotic value using Stirling's formula. At the end of the day, when you do all these things, you find a very complicated formula for entropy. Where is it? For example, just to scare you, the entropy formula, it is going to be a function of energy and volume. So you have a formula in which entropy is given as a function of energy. And then you can invert this formula find out entropy as a function of energy, as a function of entropy. And then also you can get from here U, that is energy as a function of S and V, and then calculate this will find out is 3 square by 4 pi m. S by nk, very complicated looking formula. Finally, when you take derivatives, you get the famous equation of state. So it's a very painful path to arrive at a very simple formula, which we know. You all know how to derive it in canonical ensemble. You simply look at the partition function, e to the power of minus beta, and then there is this volume, and then 1 over n factorial L by H, and then V to the power of n. And then it's a very simple Gaussian integral. Once you have this, you can get log of partition function, free energy. And in a straightforward way, you can get equation of state. Whereas in a microcanonical ensemble, even for this very simple thing, it's very complicated. This also tells you that the phase space is very simple when the coordinates do not appear explicitly. Once you have positions coming explicitly, the energy has also potential energy, then the phase space becomes very very, very complicated. And if you look at the constant energy surface, they break apart into pieces and so on. Anyway, I will not go into the detail. Can I take 5 more minutes? So far I have discussed microcanonical ensemble. Conceptually, it's very simple. It just tells you whether you have a classical system or a quantum system, count the number of states, many body states. And you will recognize that the counting is very hard because the number of states is exponentially exploding with the number of degrees of freedom. And Ansager managed to do this counting analytically in 2 dimension. So you got the famous Ansager solution. Even now, we do not know how to do this counting when you apply an external magnetic field. That's an outstanding problem in two-dimensional statistical mechanics. Similarly, if you organize a spin into a 3-dimensional lattice, like a cubic lattice, it's difficult to solve it analytically. And that will be a million-dollar question. OK. Now we come to grand canonical ensemble, canonical ensemble. So here, in this problem, for example, in this approach, if I want to study a particular temperature, I find out the slope. And when that slope is equal, the inverse of that is temperature, then I focus on all states with that energy or in the neighborhood of that energy. It's like a delta function. Basically, when I count the strength of the delta function. Now, even as we saw for ideal gas, similarly, when you study spin system, this is very difficult analytically. Even physically, perhaps this is not really useful, because the way that I think about a physical system is I imagine, let's say, water filled in this container. And many things may be happening, but I focus on a very small volume. And if I make measurement in this small volume, since it is macroscopic, things don't fluctuate much. It behaves like a macroscopic body. But however, if I focus on that, it exchanges energy. So this condition is kind of artificial. So I have a system, subsystem, which is exchanging energy. It is also exchanging particles. So sometimes some particles will enter, sometimes will go out. So that should be, to make things really more realistic, I should be able to give up this constraint of constant energy and fix a mean value and then move around it. Because if I take this volume, there is a mean energy, definitely, a very sharp mean value. and there is a fluctuation around it, which may be thermodynamically small, but still it is there. Now, the next important thing is, if I give that degree of freedom, calculation, mathematical calculation may become very easy. In fact, that's what indeed happens, like in the case. So now, let the next few minutes, I will discuss how do you get Gibbs distribution function and canonical distribution using a very simple argument that was given by I want to this argument is somewhat similar to what we had before. So let me look at a big system and focus on a very small system. Let the energy of this system be E1, the number of particles be N1, and the energy of this system is E2, number of particles. So we will call this as a medium, and this is a system of interest. It is small compared to the medium, but still macroscopic. In other words, E2 is much greater than E1. Similarly, N2 is much greater than N1. Now, when you think about the microstates, as we discussed before, if in a microcanonical ensemble, if I think about the total system, this will be a function of the number of microstates of this subsystem and the rest of the system. Of course, the total energy is E1 plus E2. Okay. Now, what I want to focus, so this I will can write it as. Now, what I want to focus, I want to focus on this particular subsystem and look at states in the neighborhood of a given microstate. So what is a microstate? A set of given momenta and a set of given position. When I consider a small volume infinitesimal volume around this given set of position and momenta. So that will have a definite energy. Let me call that energy as E, E1. That is, I focus on a single microstate. Then ask the question, what is the probability for that to occur? That will be basically, this will become 1 because I'm focusing on one microstate. And I'm considering a small volume around that. So if I integrate over this, then I will get back omega 1. Okay. So this is the probability of finding a given microstate in a subsystem, this and this. Now, this is the medium for me, which I have rewritten in terms of S. Now, you can rewrite E2 as E1 minus E minus E1. Now, you can imagine what I'm going to do now. This E1 is very small compared to the total energy. So what I can do is, I can expand this entropy of the big subsystem about its own mean energy, and then in powers of epsilon. In other words, what I do is, now, we all know that this, if you, I'm not doing a, I'm being very sloppy, but basically, when you look at it at the proper energy of the mean energy of the subsystem, sorry. So this will become this is basically a definition of temperature, and then KBT comes with the definition of S. So you will have this becomes dP dQ times exponential of some S2 energy of the subsystem, which is an uninteresting factor. For me, what is important is times e to the power of, when you do things correctly, it will be energy E1 of the subsystem, which is nothing but the Hamiltonian of the subsystem at a given positions and configuration. I have not done anything profound, just taken this, focused on a particular microstate and its neighborhood, and then the rest of the system is defined by this volume factor. Then that is where entropy comes. I expand it in powers using the fact that E1 is very small compared to E. And then comes back my energy E1, which is the energy of a microstate. So I have gotten the result I wanted. That is, what is the probability that I will have a microstate in a subsystem which is embedded in a background system at the temperature T, is this famous Boltzmann factor. Please repeat this calculation. It's fairly straightforward, but it's very important. It tells you that by considering a microcanonical ensemble, focusing on a subsystem, in a very natural way, you get this. Now, this is something interesting. Now, if you go back to this in terms of microcanonical, what essentially happens is that, okay, I will finish with that derivation. So this is Boltzmann distribution function, the very celebrated Boltzmann distribution. So for classical statistical mechanics, you'll have n factorial and so on. So by focusing on a small subsystem and imagining that the rest of the system has some notion like a temperature through entropy, I get this. Now, I leave it as an exercise. You can rewrite this whole thing as so in order to do this, what I do is I simply introduce in this identity. That is, I say that I just insert this identity inside. Because if I pick up any configuration, it will have some definite energy. So as I integrate over delta function, we'll always get one. Now I insert it here, and then interchange the integration. Then you get this interesting formula, which is, let me read it, it is beta epsilon. Because this h becomes, because of delta function, an energy. And then the number of microstates, which I rewrite it as exponential of entropy times t. It's a very important formula which says in canonical distribution, two things happen. One is there is a Lagrange multiplier, beta, which is going to fix you the mean energy or the internal energy. Then there is something else, which is a volume of phase space. So if you look at this quantity as a function of energy, this is decaying exponentially fast with energy. So if I look at the curve, yeah, this is something heuristic, but very important to appreciate. The curve has two factors, that is, this integrand has something which is exponentially decaying. And there is something omega epsilon, which is rising exponentially. So if you take the product, it leads to you some maximum. And then what is interesting is you can show, if I had, maybe I will show it in the next class, that this indeed happens here. And since this omega grows as e to the power of plus n times entropy per particle as some large number, so the weight of this probability factor which is inside, because this is like a probability distribution function, I'm finding out the norm of that. So that probability, because of the first term, it is pulling it down with energy. The second term is pulling it up, so the product is like this. So in a microcanonical ensemble, you choose that exact thing as a delta function. In a canonical ensemble, you choose essentially a Gaussian with some width. I think since it's very interesting, I will not. I will complete this. Is that okay? But I think then that I will feel satisfied. It's a very important. So this is fairly straightforward. That is, rewriting the. So here, what I am doing is, I am going from integration over phase space into integration over total energy. So in order to achieve that, I introduce a delta function like this. And then basically, the integration over phase space gives me this omega e factor, basically a number of states, volume of phase space, which I rewrite like this. Now, since, as I said, this quantity is extensive, it's proportional to the number of particles and so on, I should be able to do some expansion, because heuristically I have something like this which is going to be sharply peaked around. So I should be able to find out the place at which the whole integrand is maximum. So how do I do that? I basically look at E minus ds E and take derivative and equate it to 0. Because I'm looking at it as a function, so it's 1 minus so it, in some sense, it brings back memory of my microcanonical ensemble. It says the temperature, the Lagrange multipliers, is related to the entropy at the corresponding energy. And this is something you could have calculated using microcanonical ensemble, which is an input here. Then you can calculate entropy. Then the most important thing is it tells you that this whole thing can be written as e to the power of minus beta, some internal energy as a function of t, minus t times n s, which is a function of t. So these things I calculate from this curve. I will not go into the detail. Times a very important factor, which is minus some u minus u t whole square divided by k excuse me. So the Boltzmann factor essentially gets a value which is like the equilibrium value. And then there is an integration over a Gaussian factor. It's as if in a grand canonical in the canonical ensemble, the energy is picked around the internal energy. And then it's a Gaussian with a width which is given by specific heat, which is related to the second derivative of this quantity. I will leave it as an exercise. It's a fairly straightforward thing. So it's very interesting, which means, and we know that specific heat, the way we define, is proportional to n, number of particles. So I have a Gaussian whose width is becoming narrower and narrower as 1 over square root of n. So in the limit n tending infinity, this Gaussian will become a delta function. So this is where the equality of a canonical ensemble and microcanonical ensemble becomes important. So mathematically, they're two equivalent in the thermodynamic, provided your specific heat is positive. It's very important. Because specific heat tells you about energy fluctuation. I have a subsystem which is communicating with the rest of the system, and how it efficiently transfers heat between the system or energy between the system is defined by the specific heat. And that specific heat, if it is positive, then the equivalence between canonical and microcanonical ensemble is exact in the thermodynamic limit, because this Gaussian will become a delta function. In other words, it will pick up just a single energy in this distribution. The way that it's happening now is, instead of a delta function, I have, with this weight, I have some Gaussian distribution whose width becomes narrower and narrower in the thermodynamic limit. Okay. Now, there are systems in which specific heat becomes negative, particularly gravitating systems. If you think about statistical mechanics of gravitating systems, this equilibrium relation between microcanonical and grand canonical ensemble specific breaks down, but still you can do statistical mechanics, because it takes some time for the gravitating system to collapse. So all these things are indications of collapse. I will not go into those points, but I just wanted to point out that we started with microcanonical ensemble, then we looked at a subsystem and did a simple calculation and showed that Boltzmann factor emerges, and then you can go back to Boltzmann factor, Boltzmann distribution function, and then see how it deviates from microcanonical ensemble, in the sense you replace a delta function, which is the basis description microcanonical ensemble, by a Gaussian, and the width of the Gaussian is controlled by a measure of energy fluctuations in the system, which is related to specific heat. Okay, I think with this I will close, and I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have.
How did you define your U? How did you define your internal energy?
Ah, okay. That's interesting. So this is my equation. I know internal energy, the entropy, formally in this equation as a function of energy. Now I solve this equation. I know the analytic form of S, that is dependence of S on E. So formally, I solve it as a function of t. So I basically invert it. That is, from here, I get an energy which is a function of t, which is what I call as internal energy, equilibrium internal energy. Then I put it back. It gives me a u, which is a function of t, and then also s, which in turn is a function of t. So this is the defining formula. Then I go to the next derivative, because I had an integral over E. Then I have a higher derivative, and the second derivative of this term is basically related to specific heat, follows in few steps, and then that's what is coming here. So I have shown that a Boltzmann distribution becomes a Gaussian distribution if you think in terms of energy, total energy as a variable. And that total energy is peaked around internal energy U of t, which I have solved from here. And then the width is correct. It's very interesting. There are situations in which specific heat diverges, for example, at a critical point. And then they diverge in a particular way in the thermodynamic limit. So there will be deviations from canonical, microcanonical at the critical point, but which can be quantified. So there are many, many interesting aspects to it. Okay, if there are no questions, thank you. So we'll meet tomorrow.